Orange 94.0, das Freiradio in Wien.
Spielarten, Kultur und Radiokunst auf Orange 94.0.
Berggasse 8. Kunst, Kultur, Literatur, Queer.
Meine Damen und Herren, ich begrüße Sie recht herzlich zur ersten Ausgabe von Berggasse 8 im Jahr 2025 und wünsche Ihnen ein erfolgreiches neues Jahr, das vermutlich für alle von uns viele Herausforderungen, nicht zuletzt aufgrund der politischen Ereignisse der letzten Wochen, bereithält. In dieser Sendung hören Sie Sprecher in Deutsch, Englisch und Französisch. Wir bringen nämlich eine Teilwiedergabe einer Veranstaltung, die im Herbst des vorigen Jahres in Wien stattgefunden hat. Zu Gast ist der vielfach ausgezeichnete kanadische Autor Kevin Lambert. Er stellt uns seinen Roman Querelle de Oberval vor, der im letzten August auf Deutsch im Sezessionsverlag erschienen ist. Es ist ein vielstimmiger, überbordender, tragischer Roman um Wutbürgertum, Ausbeutung und Umweltzerstörung, um enthemmte Sexualität, die Ästhetik des Verbrechens und den verzweifelten Kampf gegen das gnadenlose Räderwerk des Kapitalismus. Machen Sie sich bereit für eine spannende Stunde mit Radio Orange.
Ja. Einen schönen guten Abend. Herzlich willkommen in der Buchhandlung Löwenherz in der Berggasse 8. Heute Abend haben wir zu Gast Kevin Lambert aus Kanada mit seinem Buch Querelle de Oberval und seinem Übersetzer Frank Weigand. Herzlich willkommen euch beiden. Frank ist nicht nur da, um die deutschen Passagen vorzutragen, sondern wir haben auch die Gelegenheit, über die Übersetzung zu reden, denn Kevins Buch ist im Französischen des Québec verfasst, sehr viele auch Regiolekt-Passagen dabei. Das war sicherlich oder bestimmt, wie man das auch aus dem Nachwort des Übersetzers erfahren kann, nicht ganz so einfach. Und er hat auch da einen ganz eigenen Ton, sowohl im Original und auch versucht, einen ganz eigenen Ton zu schaffen in der deutschen Übersetzung, was durch die Spracheigentümlichkeiten ja nicht immer so ganz einfach ist. Auch dazu heute Abend viel zu hören. Es ist nicht Kevins erstes Buch. Wir haben auch ältere Bücher auch davor auf dem Tisch liegen. Die gibt es nur auf Französisch. Auf Deutsch ist das tatsächlich das erste Buch. Im Berliner Schweizer Sezessionsverlag erschienen. Der Verleger wollte auch, ist aber den Unbilden der Nachwehen des Wetters zum Opfer gefallen und leider nicht da. Ja. Herzlich willkommen euch beide. Wir wollen es so machen, dass wir natürlich Passagen aus dem Französischen hören, aus der deutschen Übersetzung und die Unterhaltung weitgehend auf Englisch führen, weil das vermutlich die meisten können und verstehen. So, I'm now switching to English. A heartily welcome to you both. And perhaps you might start with a small introduction of yourself, of your writing, and of the book.
Okay, well, you can also start introducing yourself. Normally it's me who introduces Kevin, but like a change. Yeah.
But I let you introduce the book and I can introduce myself. So yeah, I grew up in the like northern region of Quebec, but well, it's kind of in the middle because it's really big Quebec, but northern from Quebec and Montreal city, and the book is set in the region that I come from, and it's my second novel. It was published in French in 2018, so yeah, it's the book I started to write after my first novel when I was, I don't know, 23 approximately. And I don't know what to say.
Did you
you have a PhD in
That's not important. That's not important. Well, I wrote four novels. My fourth novel is coming out next week in France and in Quebec.
Yeah. And I think what is important to know, because you just mentioned the Québécois, which is not exactly the same as French, mm-hmm. that there's two versions of Querelle in a certain way, like the Québécois original that came out in 2018, and then 1 year later there was the French edition.
French edition, yeah, and some expressions were changed because they were too hard to understand, because I work with the language that is like specific from the region that I'm from, and it's like a more popular oral kind of Quebec French, and so for the France people it was, some expressions were too difficult to understand, so
yeah, that's what they say.
Yeah, like, that's what they say.
Okay, so you want me to present the book? I think
you do the interview.
Yeah, I do the interview. Like, no, because yesterday we were thinking about how to present this book. Like I said, like when I was working on the translation, people kept on asking me, "What is this book about? You're translating Querelle de Robert Val." And I tried to tell them, well, it's on the one hand side, it's about a workers' union story, like a strike in a sawmill of workers who want to change their working conditions, like a social novel. And on the other hand side, you have this character from this long-time forbidden book from 1946, I think, from Jean Genet, who is kind of this gay myth who appears in the middle of the strike and is kind of pushes the whole thing into if you want to say, an escalation of sex and violence, mm-hmm. in a certain way.
Yeah. Yeah, my first idea about this book was really to write about a strike in a sawmill. When I was in school, like really young, in preschool, I guess, you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. My school bus was going every day on a road where it was car sellers, people that sell cars. They were, during that year, that school year, they were on a strike for, I think, all the year. So every day we saw them, in the school bus, and we didn't really understand what they were doing, why those adults were outside in the winter, and, it's so cold in Quebec, winter, right? It's, minus 30, and what did they do around this fire on the side of the street? And I also remember, the discourse during my childhood about striking workers. It was mainly negative, even if people had sometimes similar conditions and should have we could have expected them to be more in solidarity with the other workers from other companies or other fields, or I remember mostly a really negative discourse about unions, and also Even from people that I know that were working class and unionized, some had a very negative point of view about unions, and they're working for the bosses. They just want it to be more complicated, and they just take our money for nothing. So I think I wanted to, writing this book, I wanted to understand the perspective of those workers that I was seeing as a child and didn't understood. And also, unions are really, there were many big strike, right? Mm-hmm. Many big strike in the region that I come from, because it's really industrial and really big companies occupy lots of place. But it was not enough for me. I wanted to write about the setup of a sawmill and capitalist extractivist economy. But I had difficulty of finding an element of chaos, and often I feel my novel or my writing begins when there is this little disorder that happens, and then the writing can really start. And so, this element of disorder was missing, and I had the idea of a gay stranger that comes from Montreal, so the big city that the workers don't really go there and have lots of misconceptions about the big city, and he arrives in the working in the sawmill, and he also has misconceptions about the region, and we kind of discover this world with his eyes, and also we discover the point of view of the workers on him. So this was the element of chaos that drove the story.
I don't know thousands of Quebecois books, but I think there's a tradition also of this very masculine stories, like hardworking people in the woods and lumberjacks, and also of social struggle.
Yeah.
But this is kind of it's maybe a bit of a cliche, but this is kind of queering this this idea of the male worker. I think I wrote it in the postface of the book, because there's like 10 years ago there was this the people who called themselves École de la Chainsaw.
Yeah.
Like people who were like in their 30s and 40s, they were all white male writers, and it was about the hardship of the people, of the men living in nature.
And yes, it was a really like romantic image of like masculinity and living in nature. But there was also no really economics in those novels. Like you guess that the characters were coming from popular background, but there was no informations about the region that I come from, for example, was colonized late it started in the mid 19th century, which is late for Canada, and the main motor for colonization was big companies that wanted to cut the woods, and they needed workers just to go in the woods and cut the woods for them, and it was companies that were either from Britain or from America, and they needed to push away indigenous people because they needed to cut their living environment, the woods they were living in. So I also felt like reading some of Quebec's book that were talking about regions that you didn't have like this background about like economic violence and extractivist violence and like those different layers of exploitation.
So would you say it's kind of an alternative narrative that you like offering, like, because it's like the sex in this book like is political in a certain way, no?
Well, the book asks the question, I think, like it tries to merge the strong desire for working condition changes, like this desire, with the sex drive, the sex desire of its main character Querelle, and the book always try to like mix those two drives together and see like, can they go together? Do they work together? Do they work the same? Because Querelle also has like this really capitalist relationship to desire. It's like sex
consumption.
Yeah, really. And he's a character for me that is like has a drive that is too big for a human being. And when he encounters the strike, it turns him on, because he's like, these people also have a drive towards social change, but he likes to see like people having a goal and trying to do something. Yeah, so I wanted to try to like mix them up and see, do they work well together or not?
Yeah, I think there's this phrase in the book, like I don't know, it's like in English you would say like normally workers union meetings are very boring things, but this time it can also give you an erection or something.
Yeah, Querelle is on Grindr during the work working meetings. Yeah,
but maybe I think to have some concrete experience of the book.
Yeah.
What we would like to read you is like the kind of outside view on Querelle.
Yeah, maybe you can start and I will find the passage.
Okay. But maybe it's nicer we hear you in the original and then I'm the German copy.
Okay. What is this word?
Forderung. I don't know. It's like Forderung. It was in the original. Uh, It's after solidarity. C'est après solidarité.
Revendication.
Anyone.
OK. Yeah, I will stop at some point and yeah. Querelle. Le mot circule, se monnaie, on se l'échange à mi-voix dans une allée du Rossi, on le grogne bien fort entre deux hot chicken au relais de motoneige. On n'a jamais vu le garçon, mais on tire son portrait comme on imagine les personnages des contes cruels et terrifiants que racontent nos cousins l'été sous la tente. Querelle à Robertval a la phénoménalité d'un bonhomme 7 heures. On parie sur son âge, il a tantôt 25, tantôt 50. Sur la couleur de sa peau et de ses cheveux, brun, vert, noir, sur la forme de sa bouche et de ses yeux. Comme la créature malveillante, il enlève les adolescents, les corrompt, les découpe, les dévore. Comme le monstre fabuleux, on ignore d'où il vient, de Montréal, de la mafia ou d'Arabie Saoudite, mais une chose est sûre, il vit dans une caverne, traîne souvent à la plage et travaille avec l'ami de ton filleul. On parle de ce fauteur de troubles, des légendes champignonnent au sujet de ses bagarres et de ses amitiés particulières. Les jeunes de la cité étudiante et du cégep de Saint-Félicien vénèrent le bel ennemi public. Ils romancent les nuits passées dans son 3,5, vendent sa queue impressionnante et les mots qu'il leur glisse à l'oreille pendant qu'il les emmanche. À tel laidron, il aurait avoué son amour. À un sport-études gymnastique, il aurait dit qu'il avait le plus beau cul ever. Un quelconque joueur des Sables de Robertval aurait passé 3 jours dans son appartement à lui servir de boy toy. Une rumeur tenace aux origines obscures veut que ce soit Querelle qui ait enlevé le petit Michael Bolduc porté disparu depuis novembre pour l'attacher dans son garde-robe et lui faire subir toutes sortes de tortures sexuelles. Ce fait divers est murmuré tout autour du lac. On l'imprime dans les papiers régionaux et on en parle à la radio dans de courtes chroniques économes de détails. On ne sait rien, sauf qu'il n'est jamais revenu après sa première journée au cégep d'Alma.
Okay, for the German version, so the chapter is called Forderungen. Querelle. Das Wort kursiert, zirkuliert, wandert von Mund zu Mund wie Münzen von einer Hand in die andere. Man raunt es sich zu auf einem Gang in der Mall, man knurrt es laut und vernehmlich zwischen zwei Hot Chicken am Imbissstand neben der Motorschlittenpiste. Man hat den jungen Mann noch nie gesehen, aber malt ihn sich aus wie einst die Schauergestalten aus den grausamen Märchen, die uns früher im Sommer nachts im Zelt die Cousins erzählten. Querelle. In Robertval gilt er als genauso sagenhaft wie der berühmte Bonhomme Setteur. Man schließt Wetten über sein Alter ab, mal ist er 25, mal 50, über seine Haut- und Haarfarbe braun, grün, schwarz, über die Form seines Mundes und seiner Augen. Wie die berüchtigte Kreatur entführt er heranwachsende Knaben, verdirbt sie, reißt sie in Stücke und verschlingt sie. Wie bei dem märchenhaften Ungeheuer weiß man nicht genau, woher er kommt. Aus Montreal, von der Mafia oder aus Saudi-Arabien. Aber eines ist sicher. Er lebt in einer Höhle, treibt sich oft am Strand rum und ist der Arbeitskollege der Freundin deines Patensohns. Der Unruhestifter ist ständig Tagesgespräch. Legenden über seine Prügeleien und seine besonderen Freundschaften schießen wie Pilze aus dem Boden. Die jungen Leute aus dem Studentenwohnheim und der Fachhochschule von Saint-Félicien verehren den schönen Staatsfeind, verklären die in seiner Zwei-Zimmer-Wohnung verbrachten Nächte, rühmen seinen beeindruckenden Schwanz und die Worte, die er ihnen ins Ohr flüstert, während er sie aufspießt. Irgendeinem hässlichen Entlein soll er seine Liebe gestanden haben, einem Gymnastikstudenten soll er angeblich gesagt haben, er hätte den schönsten Arsch ever. Ein x-beliebiger Spieler der Sabre de Robertval soll einmal 3 Tage in seiner Wohnung verbracht und ihm als Boy-Toy gedient haben. Einem hartnäckigen Gerücht ungeklärter Herkunft zufolge sei es Querelle gewesen, der den kleinen seit November für vermisst erklärten Michael Bolduc entführt habe, um ihn gefesselt in seinem Kleiderschrank mit allen möglichen Sexualpraktiken zu traktieren. Rund um den See tuschelt man über den Vorfall, man druckt was dazu in den Lokalzeitungen, man spricht darüber im Radio in kurzen Beiträgen mit spärlichen Details. Man weiß nichts. Nur, dass er nie von seinem ersten Tag an der Fachhochschule in Alma zurückkehrte. Jeder Kolporteur dieser schlüpfrigen Neuigkeit, jede Marktschreierin, die etwas zu den Launen des charmanten Entführers hinausposaunt, trägt nicht nur zur Aufklärung bei, sondern zur allgemeinen Fabulierlust. Mit jeder neuen Runde, die die Geschichte macht, wird in puncto Pornografie noch ein bisschen dicker aufgetragen, wenn die Schwere der Angelegenheit und der raunende Tonfall noch ein Stückchen dramatiker, werden dem Strauß blutiger Bilder ein paar Nelken hinzugefügt. Die Wahrheit im Fall Michael Bolduc ist nicht bei den Journalisten zu finden, sondern eher auf den Stühlen der Friseursalons, in den Restaurants, im Einkaufszentrum, wo man sich erzählt, Michael wäre freiwillig seiner Großfamilie entflohen, seinen etwas hippiemäßigen Eltern, zwei Ärzten, die der Hälfte aller Einwohner der Region Lac-Saint-Jean schon die Drüsen befühlt haben. Echt aufgeschlossen und gut zu ihren Kindern. Er ist der Spross einer wohlbekannten Sippe aus der Gegend. Einen solchen Stempel wird man nie mehr los. Oh, du bist der Sohn von Chantal. Dein Vater hat mir das Leben gerettet. Das heißt, Michael mochte seine Familie nicht. Er habe immer wieder hysterisch losgebrüllt, dass er sie hasste, wenn seine Eltern ihm unbeeindruckt vom Theater, das er veranstaltete, Hausarrest erteilten. Jeder weiß, dass Michael den präzisen Erwartungen seines Vaters und seiner Mutter entkommen wollte, den guten Noten, die sie in seinem Zeugnis zu finden hofften, dem vielversprechenden Studium, für das sie ihn eingeschrieben hatten, dem Studentenjob, den er sich suchen sollte, um eine monatliche Abgabe an sie zu entrichten, obwohl sie stinkreich sind. Seit der Sache mit Michael Bolduc hoffen sämtliche Familienväter aus Roberval, dass ihre rebellischen Teenager nicht auch verschwinden, nicht auch die Flucht ergreifen, um sich aufs Widerlichste verrenkt in den Arm des perversen Schönlings zu verlieren. Ob er im Supermarkt einkauft oder durchs Einkaufszentrum bummelt, ständig kassiert Querelle von den Erzeugern aus der Gegend aggressive Blicke. Er interpretiert diese als Begierde und stellt sich vor, es wären Einladungen, ihnen auf die Toilette zu folgen. Vielleicht täuscht er sich gar nicht mal so sehr und im Blick der Väter, die ihre Sprösslinge vom Appetit eines Raubtiers bedroht sehen, liegt tatsächlich eine heimliche Lust darauf, von eben diesem Tier zu kosten. Die querell zürnenden Väter sind sich des sexuellen Potenzials ihrer Söhne durchaus bewusst. Insgeheim begehren sie selbst diesen vollkommenen Raum, die Wölbung zweier Pobacken, in deren Herzen ganz Roberval sich einzunisten träumt. Die Triebe der Väter, ihre unaussprechlichen Begierden, nähren ihre aggressive, brutale Wut auf Querelle. Indem sie die sexuelle Passivität ihrer Sprösslinge erahnen, indem sie sich vorstellen, wie der Arbeiter die Jünglinge besteigt, um dieses Bild sofort wieder aus ihrem Kopf zu verscheuchen, indem sie unablässig, um es zu korrigieren, in der Bewegung oder der Sprechweise ihres Sohns nach etwas suchen, das als ein Zeichen gedeutet werden könnte, ein diskretes Beben, das von dem Bedürfnis nach einem Schwanz zeugen würde, bringen die Väter dieses Zeichen erst hervor und führen gleichzeitig das Bedürfnis herbei. Ihre Entdeckung wird rasch von einer Unruhe verdrängt. Und was, wenn sich jemand anders darum kümmert? Die pure Möglichkeit, ein anderer Hengst könnte sich in das Hinterteil ihrer Kleinen versenken, lässt die Väter vor Kummer vergehen, stürzt sie in die irrsinnigsten Ängste, wenn Zacharie oder Simeon spät nach Hause kommen. Dann beweinen die von Sorge gepeinigten Väter die ganze Nacht lang ihre atavistische Blutschande am Busen ihrer sie tröstenden Gattin. Sie wissen, dass Querelle draußen sein Unwesen treibt. Morgen bekommt Zacharie Hausarrest. Simeon antwortet nicht auf ihre besorgten Textnachrichten. Er könnte dem Zuhälter ins Netz gegangen sein. Was tut er gerade meinem Sohn an? Fragt sich der schlaflose Vater. Mit dieser Frage endet ihre Fantasie und die Realität beginnt. Simeon quiekt unter Querelles Hand, die sein Stöhnen erstickt, während das ganze Wesen des Arbeiters in seinem Schwanz zusammenströmt, mit dem er die Eingeweide des braven Jungen durchpflügt, der nicht genug kriegen kann. Simeon ist wunschlos glücklich. Zacharie wird morgen angesichts der Wut seines Vaters jubeln. Eines Tages wird er gar nicht mehr nach Hause kommen, weil er der Leibwichser einer schönen Statue geworden ist. Bei gemeinsamen Angel- und Jagdausflügen ficken die Väter miteinander, um die Verwirrung über ihre ungestillten Fantasien zu vergessen. Im öffentlichen Raum nehmen diese Wahnvorstellungen die Form erbitterter Kampagnen zur Bestrafung von Pädophilen und Blutschändern an. Man schlägt vor, sie am Wegesrand zu kreuzigen, ihnen die Klöten abzuschneiden und sie den Schnäbeln der Raben zu überlassen. Damit wäre ein Exempel statuiert. Wenn sie in einer Kneipe oder Jagdhütte unter sich sind, erklären sie einander ihre Weltsicht anhand nachgewiesener Fakten. Wie von Flugzeugen in den Himmel gepustete Chemikalien die Bevölkerung kontrollieren, wie Autos die Umwelt verschmutzen, wie Aluminiumpartikel in der Luft die Neurotransmitter in unseren Gehirnen blockieren, wie Pestizide in der Nahrung weltweit den IQ senken und das Sperma ausdünnen. Der Samen in der westlichen Welt enthält immer weniger Testosteron, wissen Sie zu vermelden. Bekanntlich wird unser Sperma dünner, wir essen nicht mehr genügend Wildfleisch. Unsere Nahrung enthält immer mehr weibliche Hormone, das ist wissenschaftlich erwiesen. Die gehen ins Sperma über und das veränderte Testosteron lässt unsere Jungs verweiblichen. Bekanntlich ist die Luft verpestet von den Treibstoffen und Zweitaktern, ganz zu schweigen von den Fischen und den Meeresfrüchten. Die nehmen all das Östrogen auf, das die Mädchen wegen der Antibabypillen in unsere Gewässer pinkeln. Das wiederum geht dann über den Organismus und beeinflusst das Erbgut der Menschheit.
Bekanntlich sind die Kinder, die geboren werden, vor allem aber die Jungs zunehmend entmännlich, verweiblicht, kastriert. Gegen die Gene ist man machtlos. Ihre Söhne sind das Produkt einer Gesellschaft, die sich bei schleichender Verweiblichung und immer stärkerem Orientierungsverlust von der globalen Biochemie ficken lässt.
So what we have here is also that you have the fathers that are kind of in the same time disturbed and totally fascinated by
Yeah, I wanted this chapter is about like the social, I call it the social rumor. Like I remember like where I come from, it was really strong. We had like all those like rumors and hypotheses about this weird person that we see every day at the mall or the park, and I don't know, I feel like the, maybe it's everywhere like this, but I feel in the region that I come from, this is really strong. Like people have always a story to tell about, and if they don't have a story, they will create it and they will tell it. And yeah, I wanted to write like out the rumors that spreads of this character, because at that point of the novel we don't know much, and in a way all the novel we don't know much about Querelle. We only know he comes from Montreal, and we learn a little bit, but it's not a character that is built like in a traditional manner with like a psychology and a background and a backstory, and there is a director who is adapting it to the cinema now, and she always gets told by the producer, yeah, but what is Querelle's backstory? And she's like, no, it's not the point. It's just like a fantasy. It's like half a human, half a fantasy. Anyway, so this chapter is, for me, is really about like how he's built from his reputation, like what circulates about him, and also how this reputation is like a delirium from the fathers that are really homophobic. Because I also remember when I was young, like we were always talking about like those young, like teenagers or young adults that were disappearing or like killing themselves, and like the parents always had like an explanation of like he was taking drugs, or he had the like suspicious friends. And And when I grew up, I began to know other boys that were killing themselves or disappeared. And I understood why they were doing this. It's because their family was awful, was so homophobic. And so I thought about all the stories that I heard as a child, and I was like, ah, that was why they just disappeared. And in this passage in particular, I wanted to also think about like this... like the drive of homophobia, like what drives homophobia, like this libidinal activity that is like at the origin of the control pulsion of the father. Pulsion de contrôle, je ne sais pas comment le traduire, mais...
C'est un contrôle trip.
We were at the Froude Museum this morning.
Yeah, exactly.
So we've
been around the corner this morning.
I feel really psychoanalytic.
About death drive. And like.
Yeah, but yeah, this pulsion de contrôle, the perversion of then the control will of the fathers, I wanted to like reverse it and explain it. I don't know if it's true, or if I don't think it has any like sociological truth, but I don't care. It's like poetic truth, but I wanted to turn it around and show that it's the homophobia and paranoia of the father that is incestuous and
but in the same time, and which is fascinating, it's just, as you said, it's just one rumor among a lot of other rumors, like this, like the I don't know, narration strategy of this novel is like you never know, actually. Like sometimes you don't know who is talking, and then if you know who is talking, you don't know if it's true.
Yeah. And, yeah. Right. Yeah. I wanted to like, I worked the narrative voice to be like connected to this social rumor. So, and also it's built like a Greek tragedy, and like in those Greek tragedies you have those moments where like the people, like the chorus, which represent the people, because the characters of the Greek tragedies are gods or kings and queens, the voice of the people, and the the function of the chorus is a little bit the same. It's to not necessarily tell. Sometimes it is like telling the story or holding the narrative, but sometimes it's also like bringing like the rumor or a point of view about what's happening. So I wanted the, like, there is no literal chorus in the book, like, but I wanted the narrative to be really linked to the function of a chorus in a tragedy. So to be close to that, like those, all the rumors that always circulate and all those rivers of talkings that surrounds us.
It's like, it's actually like in any chapter, in the beginning you always think it's one voice, and then suddenly you have other voices that are kind of overlapping or interrupting.
Yeah.
Or
yeah, because yeah. Sometimes I like the narration embraces the point of view of one character, and it's also interesting because it's about like querelle in French also means conflict, right? So it's about a working conflict, but the novel is also built like a conflict because you have all those characters that are part of the sawmill strike, and they don't all agree together, and they don't have the same point of view about their working conditions or even the world in itself. So this is interesting for me in the novel, where when you can have access to different point of views on the same subject, and that they don't agree together.
No, and there's this passage, like I think, like, which I didn't plan, but I think it's like interesting to read, because like for about 150 pages in this book, you kind of build up like the workers, and they have their meetings, and they have their conflict with the boss who's so evil, and like and you kind of, even if they're homophobic and very egoistic, you start to feel sympathy for
them.
Yeah,
you root for the workers, yeah.
And then on page 150, I will just read this very short thing. It starts like, jetzt muss aber mal die Wahrheit gesagt werden. Die Schilderung der Unabwägbarkeiten eines Gewerkschaftskampfs hat bei der geneigten Leserin oder dem geneigten Leser vielleicht den Eindruck der Parteinahme von Seiten des Textes aufgrund allzu großer Sympathie fürs Faulenzen und die Streikenden erweckt. Dabei könnte der Standpunkt, der in diesem Buch vertreten wird, kaum eindeutiger sein. Das Genie unserer Zeit heißt Unternehmertum. Ich, Kevin Lambert, Autor dieser äußerst bescheidenen Fantasie, beziehe hier und jetzt auf Seite 150 in aller Deutlichkeit Stellung für die Arbeitgeberschaft und gegen die Niederträchtigkeit der Streikenden, die ich auf den vorhergehenden und noch folgenden Seiten so wahrheitsgetreu wie möglich zu beschreiben versucht habe. So it's like, is it like sabotage of your own novel?
Yeah. The goal is also to bring, because we give a lot of authority to the name of an author, right? Yeah. Even more if it's in the book, but it's kind of absurd, because especially in fiction, like why the name of the author should have authority? And in this passage, I wanted kind of to kick the card castle, sur le château de cartes, like just to kick it. And for me, it's an invitation to the reader to also to not submit to the authority of the narrative, right? Because when you read, like, reading is not a revolutionary act. Often we just obey what the narrator tells us, and we just submit to this point of view, and we take it for granted. We take it for the reality of the book. But even so, I wanted to, in this passage, to really like trouble everything. And because it's not my personal opinion, of course, but I thought it was like funny and ironic to do this. But also for me, it was like my dream was to hope that like a reader would like be really angry against the book, but would also challenge everything now that the narration tells, right? Because why, if you don't accept the authority of the narrator at this point, why should you submit to what he or she or the voice says on other parts of the book?
But I think,
But that was what I asked myself when I read this very passage, because you constantly do that. Mm. So, and the passage we heard before, it's in the midst of the novel, and we have learned about Carrel, about his participating with the other workers in the strike, and fucking with boys, and very special things, not necessarily his character, but what he is doing. And now you there's a myth. He might be that. He might be 15. He might be 50. So you do constantly in the whole book, and you are transforming reality to a myth, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So, what I ask myself: why did you feel it so now to beat like with a hammer on the reader to check? Oh. He's constantly transforming everything, and he's telling the contrary of that was what the text says. Mm-hmm. So, why did you feel this to put this on top of this always changing and twisting? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I wanted to imagine, as it is a novel of conflicts, I also wanted to imagine like a kind of as I said a question about authority of the novel itself. So yeah, for me, it was by doing what we just read, but also by I tried to write always at the level of the fantasy. So not the fact. I don't really care about the facts, but what I care about is how we process things in ourselves, in our inner lives that are so complex and weird and my goal would be to write at the level of the subconscious, like how our subconscious sees the world and understand things, and it's really different, than our like rational understanding. So I try to be always, and sometimes of course it's like a utopia, because you cannot always be at the level of the fantasy. Sometimes you have to give facts and states situation and talk about characters and write a scene, and so it's like I kind of failed to do it right, but it was an idea that was always working in me while I was writing the novel, this like unsureness of things, but not just to doubt, also to be at the level of how people like in their inner life and feelings understand reality and see reality. And there's another passage where it's from the point of view of another worker who's called Jezabel, and she there is one passage that she explains the world to herself and how she see like exploitation and how capitalism invades everything is not the same from, for example, one of her colleagues that thinks it's a like a complot. A plot against workers, now we talk more about this, like the conspiracy theory and so on. But the world I grew up in was a big conspiracy theory. Like everybody had their thought about the government and now we see the consequences, like social and political consequences of this. But even when we were a child, I remember in the school, we were little conspiracists. I remember, like, one of my favorite anecdotes was there was this old man that was using a chariot, like for a baby carriage, and he was carrying not a baby but onions and carrots and vegetables, and we saw him, and probably was just really old, and he wasn't able to bring his own like bags because he was like old and sick. But as Charles, what we were telling about him in the school, and it was a really famous, a very famous story, that is that he was injecting drugs in the vegetables, and he was selling them in the houses of the neighborhoods, and many families had died from eating his onions. So I remember very well this episode, and everybody believed it, and we were always talking about. And when we saw him in the school court, we were like, ah! We were very afraid, but this is just an example. But for me, everything works like this. I think we like sometimes like our fake ideas and sometimes we're not even aware that we have those ideas, but they are even more important in our decisions than our beliefs. I don't know if I answered your question talking about onions, but sorry.
But the interesting thing, like with the onions, they appear in your first novel. Mm-hmm. Like the old man with the onions and the drugs inside the onions is like the story that they always tell. No, he really appears.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And I think in the first novel, because I think there's also another aspect, is like this playing a little bit with the autofiction, which is a very popular genre, actually. Mm-hmm. Like, with, I don't know if people always asked you, like, so how is it connected to your own personal life, what you're writing? Are you Kerel? Mm-hmm. Would you like to be Kerel? and the funny thing, like, in your very first novel, where you have the story, which is obviously authentic, you have a character who's called Kevin Lambert, mm-hmm. and who in the end commits suicide.
Yeah.
Because he has a love story with the narrator of the story. So is there this what I call sabotage, but is there this idea of like playing with the fact that everybody, like we have a tendency, I don't know, if we want mm-hmm. to understand something, like why did he write this? Is it maybe connected to his own life?
Yeah.
Do you use this or is it just an act of resistance?
Well, Querelle and Que notre joie demeure are not autobiographical books at all. That's why I'm not Querelle. It's funny to say this. But the more autobiographical part of this novel is more the setup, right? It's the, like, many of the workers from the sawmill are inspired from, like, aunts and uncles and people that I grew up with, and so yeah, the most autobiography in this book would be this. But in my first book was more autobiographical in its setup also, but I didn't want it to be, like, I wanted to write a story about, like, a queer child in the city I grew up in that tells story about onions, and but I didn't want people to read it as autofiction, which is really and was really popular and it still is. So that, like, putting a character that had my name, like putting my name in it, was just to like fuck things up and say, yeah, you cannot expect that the main character is simply me, because it isn't. He destroys his hometown at the end of the novel, and I didn't do this yet. But so I didn't want it this, like, I don't know, too easy and common. Mm.
But as you asked about translation, like in your introduction, I think the difficult thing translating this novel was not actually like to work with this Québécois, which is different from French, but to find a general tone for this whole book. Because, like, sometimes you do like two phrases and you think, like, okay, this is irony. Then suddenly it gets very serious, and then suddenly it becomes something different, and you have, like, in the same phrase, suddenly another person appears and they're contradicting each other. This was, I think, the real challenge, and I'm not always sure if it's exactly like in the original, but what I tried to create maybe is like something like polyphonic or in a certain way. Yeah.
But you cannot cut, like, even in the original, you cannot say, oh, up to this point, the sentence is thinking of this character, and after this comma, it's another. It doesn't work like this. It's more blurry, so it's normal. Yeah,
but, like, without going too much into the details of the translator's kitchen, but, like, it was really interesting. Like, because we worked a long time, like with my editor, with Christian, who's unfortunately not here, because it's very long phrases. Sometimes it's like very, very long sentences. And, like, in the beginning, I had more the idea, like, let's make it more digestible for the German reader, and let's cut them maybe like one in three. And then Christian read it and he said, yeah, but it's a flow, and let's try to reconnect them. And then I understood that actually it's very important that it always continues and you have, like, these contradictions inside the same sentence. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have another question, because you said you had this idea of writing about the strike and about working class people, and then you were looking for something disturbing and found Gay Querelle.
Mm-hmm.
But is it possible to tell this story without Carel? So has he been there in the first place? Because the story would be kind of trivial if you tell just these working class prejudices and the bosses' prejudices against their workers, and the whole thing is that you are the whole book is something. It's quite how gain is as a concept. A concept of society is built as a myth, and the myth is something that works on us as being gay and our own ideas of how we are gay. So, is it is there really a separate version?
No, it's not a separate version. It's more the ideas that I had, like, really before writing the book, like the thinking about what I want to write. But no, I don't think it would have worked, because it would have been, I think, a really straight story, like of a conflict, and more realistic also, because Carel is also the character that allows to break realism, because even there are some passages that are really almost documentary. Like I talk about, for example, all the process of wood of a tree, like from the wood to the sawmill, and like all the steps. And this is almost documentary, but it's not realism in a literary way. It's so in the book there are documentary and really aspects that are really anchored to a social reality, but also Carel allows me to break this aesthetic, and not just to build a regular straight aesthetic, but to make it more baroque. And because at the end we haven't talked about it yet, but it's not realistic at all. It goes like the drive of Carel meets the drive of the sawmill, and also the drive of Jezabel, which is another important character that is also like has a strong drive, but it's more.
She's the real hero in a certain way.
Really. It could have been Carel and Jezabel de Robertval. Yeah. She's really important too. But there are two drives mixed, and then the story goes nuts, and everything falls apart literally.
Yeah. I mean, we could read some of the very surreal ending if you want.
You choose.
Because there's a, like, I don't know if we should tell about the end, because we don't want to spoil
not
the book.
Not too much, but
like,
yeah. I was vague, I think.
Okay, so maybe we shouldn't. In this case, I'm not reading the thing with the little angels, and like, which is a bit like what we saw in the museum this afternoon, because we went to see like all the Rubens and the Bosch. No, but maybe as we talked about the other character, which is kind of a sister of Carel in a certain way, Jezabel, is like the female main character. She's like a working woman in this factory. She's like, I don't know if we say she's bisexual or she's queer. Because she's she doesn't make any difference, like who
but
she's
she
attracted to, or like
she states more clearly her attractiveness to other women at the contact of Carel. So it kinds of
And maybe we can I have this. actually, it's the passage you were speaking about just right before. Do you want to read like? Like it's like after the curtains of Organza. Like
what is the first sentence?
Quand Jezabel s'en va
en se rendant au piquetage tôt
oui,
ce matin.
Voilà,
okay.
C'est ça.
Okay.
Okay.
En se rendant au piquetage tôt ce matin, Jezabel voit la ville s'éveiller. C'est une journée moins froide que les autres. Elle décide de marcher. Elle reviendra ce soir en prenant le livre d'un de ses collègues. En se dirigeant vers le chemin Saint-Hubert, elle est témoin du commencement de la journée d'ouvrage des travailleuses de Robertval. Les serveuses des cantines enfilent leurs bas collants et leurs tabliers, leurs chaussures à semelles orthopédiques pour absorber la dureté de la céramique sur laquelle tu passes la journée debout. Les œufs cassent sur la plaque brûlante des cuisinières en sueur pour être aussitôt servis, puis avalés par les couvreuses qui gobent des assiettes pleines de patates, de saucisses arrosées de café fort, se réveiller, se faire un bon fond avant la job pour toffer jusqu'à la pause du midi. Jezabel observe, en sortant avec le soleil, les couvreuses vêtues d'épaisses soutes d'hiver couchées à plat sur les toits. Elles sentent le goudron, jouent de la cloueuse sur une charpente récente, érigée à la fin de l'automne, ou arrachent du vieux bardeau raidi par le froid. Dès 7 heures du matin, elles sont là, salariées par des entrepreneuses qui ne suspendent leurs activités que 2 ou 3 mois par année, quand la température polaire devient insoutenable. Les couvreuses se lancent à la tête des jokes grasses et des débris à envoyer dans les containers. Elles rient fort, ça fait chier le monde qui dort encore, les infirmières et les factrices qui reviennent de leur shift de nuit à l'hôpital ou de leur tournée matinale. Elles se recouchent 1 heure avant que les enfants arrivent de l'école pour dîner. Je vais te laisser continuer. Okay.
Als sich Jezabel heute früh auf den Weg zum Streikposten macht, sieht sie die Stadt erwachen. Es ist weniger kalt als sonst, sie beschließt zu Fuß zu gehen. Auf dem Rückweg wird sie sich heute Abend von einem ihrer Kollegen mit dem Auto mitnehmen lassen. Unterwegs zum Chemin Saint-Hubert erlebt sie den Beginn des Arbeitstags der werktätigen Frauen von Robert Wall. In den Kantinen ziehen die Kellnerinnen ihre Strumpfhosen, ihre Schürzen und ihre orthopädisch besohlten Schuhe an, die die Härte des Keramikbodens dämpfen sollen, auf dem du den ganzen Tag im Stehen verbringst. Schwitzende Köchinnen schlagen über glühenden Herdplatten Eier auf, die sofort serviert und anschließend von den Dachdeckerinnen verschlungen werden, die tellerweise Kartoffeln und Würstchen mit starkem Kaffee runterspülen. Es gilt, schnell wach zu werden und sich eine gute Grundlage zum Randklotzen bis zur Mittagspause zu schaffen. Als sie mit der aufgehenden Sonne das Haus verlässt, beobachtet Jezabel flach auf den Dächern liegende Dachdeckerinnen in dicken Winteroveralls. Sie riechen nach Teer, setzen die Nagelmaschine auf einem im Spätherbst erst errichteten Dachstuhl ein oder reißen alte, von der Kälte brüchig gewordene Schindeln aus. Ab 7 in der Früh sind sie da, angeheuert von Unternehmerinnen, die ihre Tätigkeit nur 2 oder 3 Monate im Jahr unterbrechen, wenn die polaren Temperaturen unerträglich werden. Die Dachdeckerinnen werfen mit derben Witzen und Schuld und Schutt für den Müllcontainer um sich. Sie lachen laut, was alle, die noch schlafen, ankotzt, die Krankenschwestern und Briefträgerinnen, die gerade von der Nachtschicht im Krankenhaus oder von ihrer Morgenrunde zurück sind und sich nochmal für eine Stunde aufs Ohr hauen, bevor die Kinder von der Schule zum Mittagessen kommen. In den Boutiquen des Carrefour Janois, in den Banken, den Geschäften auf dem Boulevard Saint-Joseph zählen die Kassiererinnen ihren Kassenbestand, bevor die stets verspätete Geschäftsführerin erscheint. Sie selbst dagegen sind pünktlich, sie können sich keine weitere Abmahnung leisten. Mit der dritten kommen Kündigungen und Beurlaubungen. Kassiererinnen gibt es hier wie Sand am Meer. Es ist, als würden im Studentenwohnheim von Robert Wall nur Arbeitskräfte mit Einzelhandelserfahrung ausgebildet. Trotz ihrer beträchtlichen Verantwortung in der Boutique und einer etwas weniger skandalösen Bezahlung sind auch die Geschäftsführerinnen lediglich Angestellte, angeheuert von Chefinnen, die sich selten persönlich vor Ort blicken lassen und die Gewinne aus den Verkäufen einstreichen, die sie in Echtzeit auf ihren Smartphones mitverfolgen. Nach Ladenschluss, wenn die Geschäftsführerin in den Feierabend geht und sie allein abrechnen, das Licht löschen und die Türen zusperren lässt, stecken die Kassiererinnen heimlich 1-2 Zwanziger in ihre Handtaschen für ein paar ordentliche Biere und ziehen los, um sich in irgendeiner Kneipe zu besaufen. Vielleicht bis dahin.
I think this was like, I had this question when I was like translating it, of course, because suddenly everything switches into female. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but in French, German is a gendered language.
Yeah, okay. Very much.
So, and the neutral is masculine. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So yeah, French is the same, right? Because in English, it's not that, right? When it was translated in English, you couldn't tell the gender of the workers. But in French, the neutral is supposed to be like masculine. So in this part, I wanted to like experiment just. It's a part where we see like you understand it, but like all the city waking up and all the kind of the fabric of the work that is all around and that you don't see or you don't think of usually. And I wanted to do this experiment of like from the point of view of Jezabel of like using a generic feminine that doesn't really exist in French. But like, what does it changes in our perceptions of reading? And And what I felt reading this is that you get to see like other people you don't see when, or you don't imagine when you use the masculine generic. Like I discovered that myself when I read les couvreurs, par exemple, which is the masculine of
people. Just dachdecker.
Yeah, right. Doing the roofs. My image was only males, but like I saw people working on a roof 3 or 4 days ago, and there were 2 females on the rooftop. And like, what does it changes in our imagination when we use the feminine? That interested me, and I always try to write with this problem of like the really gendered French. And but I always use different solutions, and like in my other book, I also work with the generic feminine, but I switch it. For example, when I do a list of things, I use like masculine, feminine, or feminine, masculine, feminine, and so I play with like what does it makes us see, or what do we don't see if it's not there? So that interested me. Yeah.
In der heutigen Sendung von Berggasse 8 brachten wir den Ausschnitt einer Veranstaltung, die im Herbst des letzten Jahres stattgefunden hat. Gast war der vielfach ausgezeichnete kanadische Autor Kevin Lambert. Er stellte uns seinen Roman Querelle de Robert Wall vor, der im letzten August auf Deutsch im Sezession Verlag erschienen ist. Weiters hörten Sie Veit Georg Schmidt und Frank Weigand. Die Sendungen der Reihe Berggasse 8 können Sie im Archiv der Freien Radios nachhören. Noch einen schönen Sonntagnachmittag und Abend wünscht und auf Wiederhören bis zur nächsten Sendung sagt Peter Supp.
Berggasse 8. Kunst, Kultur, Literatur, Queer.